Hello, and thank you for joining the American Revolution. Today, episode 143, General Burgoyne's Northern Army. General Johnny Burgoyne got London's approval to lead an army south from Quebec to capture the Hudson Valley, Albany, and link up with the larger army in New York City. General Burgoyne arrived in Quebec in May 6, 1777. From there, he traveled upriver to Montreal, where he met with commanding general in Canada, Sir Guy Carleton. Although Burgoyne was going to take a large force of several thousand soldiers, he did not have any generals under his command. However, he did appoint quite a few colonels to be generals in America for the purposes of this mission. Today I want to go through some of those officers who became key members of what would become known as the Saratoga Campaign. The first man I want to mention is Simon Fraser. General Fraser came from a Scottish clan with a long military history. Most of the clan was either executed or had its land seized for participation in the Jacobite uprising and fighting the English in the Battle of Culloden in 1747. It's not clear if Fraser himself fought at Culloden. If he did, it's not something he would want people to know about. Fraser obtained a commission in the Dutch Army the same year as the Battle of Culloden as part of the Scots Brigade. This is just my speculation, but he may have been able to escape the battle along with his fellow Scots and joined a foreign army as a means of starting a new life. That same year, he was wounded in Bergen-op-Zoom against the French in what was part of the War of Austrian Succession. Like many other Scots on the losing side of the Jacobite uprising, Fraser eventually returned to Britain after some time abroad and did join the British Army, probably to help rebuild the Fraser name. He purchased a lieutenant's commission in 1755 and soon left for America. There, he served under his uncle, Colonel Simon Fraser, where young Lieutenant Fraser distinguished himself at the Siege of Louisbourg in 1757 and was promoted to captain. He also fought with General Wolfe at the Siege of Quebec. After the British secured Canada, Fraser continued his service in the Seven Years' War by serving under Ferdinand of Brunswick in what is today Germany. His service allowed him to advance to the rank of major and then lieutenant colonel by the end of the war. After that, he served at Gibraltar for a time, then moved to Ireland. In 1770, he served as quartermaster general of Ireland and there developed a friendship with General Johnny Burgoyne. When Burgoyne prepared his 1776 invasion of New York, he requested that Irish regiments under Colonel Fraser be part of that invasion. As you may recall from back in episode 95, Colonel Fraser played an active role in expelling the Continental Army from Canada at the Battle of Three Rivers. Carleton granted Fraser a field promotion to Brigadier General so that he could command multiple regiments involved in the fighting. Following Three Rivers, Fraser continued to serve in his role as Brigadier General in America. Fraser also led forces down Lake Champlain later that year. Following the Battle of Valcour Island, his army moved within sight of Fort Ticonderoga, only for General Carleton to declare it was too late in the season and that the army should pull back to Canada. General Fraser shared the frustration of many officers that they did not take Ticonderoga at that time. As the 1777 campaign began, Burgoyne returned from London to Canada with clear authority to assume command of the New York invasion and leave General Carleton in Canada. Burgoyne tapped Fraser to be one of his top field commanders. Burgoyne's other key general was Friedrich Adolf Riedesel. He commanded the regiments of Brunswickers who the British had hired to supplement the regulars in Canada. Again, although they are from Brunswick, I'm going to usually refer to them using the generic term German for the sake of simplicity. There were some members of other German principalities mixed up with this army. I may also occasionally slip up and just call them Hessians. But the German-speaking soldiers in Burgoyne's army were primarily from the Principality of Brunswick. Oradazel was the second son of a baron. In the German tradition, he would use the title of baron like his father, but he would not inherit any estates. His father wanted him to study law. Oradazel began legal studies, but grew bored and instead took a commission in the army at age 17. His father was outraged at this decision and cut him off from all financial assistance. Over time, though, father and son would reconcile. Oradazel soon began to receive his allowance again, which allowed him to live in the proper style of a gentleman. Ensign Radazel's first appointment in 1755 was to London, where he began to learn English and French. The following year, though, the Seven Years' War required his return to the continent. Radazel served as an aide to Ferdinand of Brunswick. For his conspicuous service at the Battle of Minden, Radazel received a promotion to Captain of Cavalry. Radazel continued to serve under Ferdinand of Brunswick when Simon Fraser joined the same staff in 1760 or 61. The two young men were certainly aware of each other, although it's not clear if they got to know each other very well at that time. In 1762, Radazel suffered a battle injury which required temporary leave so that he could recover. While he was not well enough to fight, he was well enough to woo and marry Frederica von Massow, the daughter of the Brunswick Commissary General. Radazel returned to duty, but by the time he did, the war had ended. In 1767, his regiment disbanded. Radazel then served as Adjutant General of the Brunswick Army. In 1772, he was promoted to Colonel. When Britain came looking to rent an army in 1776, the Duke of Brunswick made a deal to send about 4,300 men to America. He promoted Radazel to Major General and gave him command of the army. Radazel's Brunswickers arrived in Quebec in June 1776, only a few days before the battle at Three Rivers. The arrival of these German reinforcements is what convinced the Continentals to abandon Sorel and retreat back to New York. Radazel's men later worked with the British in the advance that resulted in the Battle of Valcour Island. As General Burgoyne prepared his New York campaign, he would rely on General Radazel to command the Germans that made up nearly half of Burgoyne's army. Another general was Major General William Phillips, who has a rather unusual background for a general. He was not of noble birth. In fact, we don't even know the month or day he was born. Records just show that he was born probably in 1731. His grandfather, Thomas Phillips, was an army captain. His father, known only as T.C. Phillips, was thought to be an officer as well, but again, we really don't know. His mother, Catherine Brudenell, was the daughter and sister of two British generals, both named Thomas Brudenell. It's likely from that side of the family that William got his start in life. As a commoner with no real money behind him, his chances of going far as an army officer were pretty slim. Instead, at around age 15, he enrolled in the new Woolwich Military Academy, which had only been in existence for a few years. The Board of Ordnance had created it in 1741 to help train artillery officers. Training in artillery and engineering were probably the best bet for an aspiring officer who did not have money or a family name behind him. During the Seven Years' War, Phillips served with distinction, noted for his ingenuity and bravery at several battles, including Minden and Warburg. He rose to the rank of Lieutenant Colonel of Artillery. After the war, Inspector General of the Artillery, and then as commander of artillery at the artillery school at Woolwich. In 1772, he received promotion to colonel and became lieutenant governor of Windsor Castle. In 1774, Phillips was elected as a member of parliament. He had made some important friends via the army, including General Henry Clinton, who helped Phillips win a seat in the House of Commons. In the spring of 1776, Colonel Phillips sailed with General Burgoyne for America. these were the first British reinforcements that pushed the Americans out of Canada. During this time period, and actually until 1855, artillery was not run by the British War Office. Artillery officers did not buy their ranks like those in the infantry and cavalry. They received promotion, ostensibly on merit and seniority, but connections didn't hurt. The Board of Ordnance ran the artillery and was responsible for promotions. So artillery officers almost never had any noble pedigree and were kind of looked down by the infantry and cavalry as essentially support staff. The Board of Ordnance worked closely with the army, being responsible for things like the production of arms and powder and the maintenance of forts and military barracks. But as I said, the board and the War Department were separate political entities within the British government. So here's where I really start to get confused. Several sources I've read say that artillery officers had no authority to give commands to infantry or cavalry officers in the field, or at least that they were not to be given general commands over armies in the field. Despite these limitations, General Guy Carleton, with the agreement of General Burgoyne, issued several commissions to various officers in preparations for the New York campaign. Generally, we find the term used general in America. These were temporary ranks to make a colonel into a temporary general for purposes of commanding several regiments, or for other junior officers to step up in rank temporarily for some limited period to meet the needs of the army. General Carleton named Phillips to be a major general in America, second in command of the expedition, below only General Burgoyne in rank. Apparently, this commission caused great concern back in London. Lord Germain wrote to Carleton in late 1776 that the use of an artillery officer was not customary and that, although he was willing to let Phillips continue in this role for the time, that it should not be considered precedential. So I guess that says something about the respect that the top generals had for Phillips, that they were willing to break with custom and precedent to give him a top command in the expedition. Burgoyne, however, did have to make clear in his standing orders that infantry and cavalry officers were to obey the orders of General Phillips as a superior officer, something that was apparently at least in question without such orders. Another commander that was to be part of this campaign was Barrymore Matthew St. Leger, known as Barry. He was a lieutenant colonel who received a temporary bump to Brigadier General in America for the campaign. St. Leger was born in Ireland to a noble Protestant family. As a younger son, he would not inherit land and title and took up a career in the military. He attended Eton and Cambridge before joining the army as an ensign at the beginning of the Seven Years' War. St. Leger served well during the war, participating in most of the important battles in Canada, the Siege of Louisbourg, the capture of Quebec, and the campaign to capture Montreal. He rose to the rank of major by the end of the war. His fighting experience in the area and his expertise in fighting what the British called Indian-style warfare made him an ideal candidate for a command position. St. Leger had become a lieutenant colonel by the beginning of the Revolution, and as I said, Carleton granted him the temporary command of Brigadier General in America. On top of that, Burgoyne granted St. Leger an independent command as part of his campaign. While Burgoyne would lead the main army straight down Lake Champlain, headed directly south toward Albany, St. Leger would take another force of about 2,000 men up the St. Lawrence River to Lake Ontario. He would then proceed east following the Mohawk River toward Albany. This would force the American defenders to divide their forces and defend against two different armies coming at them from different directions. British regulars and Hessians made up the bulk of Burgoyne's invasion force. Burgoyne also had two regiments of British militia, the King's Royal Regiment and the Queen's Rangers. These were primarily English-speaking Canadians or loyalists from New York. Although London expected Burgoyne to supplement his army with local loyalists, it appears only about 250 joined his expedition. In addition, about 400 Native American warriors joined with Burgoyne's expedition. The local Iroquois tribes had determined that they would remain neutral in this conflict. The British recruited tribes that lived further north and west in Canada. The British records don't make clear exactly which tribes participate and in exactly which numbers, but British Indian agents spread the word that the army was looking for support and that warriors from various tribes turned out to fight. Supporting the British army meant a chance for plunder. It also meant improved relations with the king, which could lead to better protection of their lands or more gifts from the government in the future. Among the warriors were some Iroquois who ignored the Confederation's official neutrality. The majority came from Algonquin, Abenaki, and Ottawa tribes. Some had come hundreds of miles away to join the expedition. The Native auxiliaries were considered an important part of the mission, despite relatively small numbers. They served as scouts and typically controlled the woods around the main column. This prevented spies or skirmishers from the enemy from getting too close to the main column. Native warriors also came with a reputation for savagery that also struck fear into the enemy. Burgoyne felt it necessary to hold a meeting with the warriors to make clear that they would have to follow the rules about not scalping living prisoners or wounded enemy on the field, and not looting the homes of loyalists in the region. His speech later became the butt of jokes in London, as a member of Parliament suggested that maybe they should release the lions from the London Zoo and just ask them not to attack any people while they roam the streets. In total, Burgoyne's command was a substantial one. I've seen contradictory evidence of the exact size, but it appears to have included over 4,000 regulars, over 3,000 Hessians, about 250 local loyalist militia, between 400 and 500 Indians, and a few hundred French-speaking draftees who primarily assisted with moving equipment and other basic labor functions. There were also nearly 1,000 camp followers, that is, women and children related to the officers and men. Typically, these women performed nursing and laundress duties for the army. Burgoyne also took a pretty substantial artillery complement of at least 32 cannon, mortars, and howitzers. Two of them were 24-pounders, which are much larger than guns that are usually taken into the field. In addition to the force led by Burgoyne, St. Leger's independent command consisted of about 2,000 men. In this case, about half of these were Indians, who it was thought would be more effective in the lengthy wilderness march. There were only about 200 regulars and another 100 Hessian Jägers. The remaining 600 or 700 were local Tories and Canadian militia. St. Leger also took about 40 artillerymen, with 4 small field cannon and a couple of mortars. General Burgoyne moved his force to Saint-Jean, at the northern tip of Lake Champlain, where General Carleton had launched his fleet a year before. The force would move down Lake Champlain to Crown Point and Fort Ticonderoga, where they would defeat the American defenders. Unlike the previous year, there would be no American fleet on the lake to prevent or even slow up the advance. From Fort Ticonderoga, the army would plan to move down the Hudson River toward Albany. There, the main army would link up with General St. Leger's secondary force, which would have taken Fort Stanwix and traveled across the Mohawk Valley to reach Albany from the west. At the same time, these two armies would meet up with General Howe's army, which would move up from New York City, up the Hudson Valley to Albany from the south. Once that was complete, Burgoyne would come under the command of General Howe and would take orders from him. Years later, a famous Prussian field marshal would note that no battle plan ever survives first contact with the enemy. As we will see in coming episodes, that is certainly true with these plans. However, as I mentioned a few weeks ago, when the British were coordinating plans for 1777, it did not appear that all the military leaders even agreed on the plans ahead of time. General Carleton had been ticked off to learn that he would not be permitted to command the campaign himself. He seems, though, to have done everything in his power to provide Burgoyne with everything he needed for the offensive. General Howe in New York had absolutely zero interest in marching up the Hudson Valley to meet Burgoyne's army in Albany. Instead, Howe planned to leave New York City and head south to capture Philadelphia. General Henry Clinton, who was left to babysit New York City with a few Hessians and local Tories, was upset that he was not given the command that Burgoyne held, even though he was more senior. He showed no interest in moving up the Hudson River either. He was complaining that he barely had enough men to defend New York City if attacked. The man who should have been coordinating all of this was Secretary of State Lord George Germain. Historians often criticize Germain for leaving his orders vague and for failing to submit a direct order to General Howe to support Burgoyne's offensive from the south. Germain had signed off on Howe's plans to attack Philadelphia, but simply noted that Howe should be sure to have that done early in the fighting season so that he could support Burgoyne near Albany later in the year. Germain seemed to have no appreciation of the difficulties of marching armies through the wilderness of upstate New York, and the fact that these armies would not have large numbers of farms or towns to provide food and other necessities. An army pushed hard in good weather might be able to march 50 miles on an open road in one day. Marching through a forest, an army might be lucky if it could march 5 miles, and that was without encountering any enemy. Instead, Germain seemed inclined to believe the complaints of lower officers, like Burgoyne himself, that the lack of success up until this point had simply been the incompetence or overcaution of more senior officers like Carleton, Howe, and Clinton, and that more daring leadership would succeed where others had failed. Of course, Burgoyne put it in terms that were a little more respectful to his superiors, but that was the general impression that he gave Germain and others in London. It was a common ploy for more junior officers who wanted to be given command opportunities over more senior ones. Burgoyne started his campaign with fewer men than he had planned. He also had fewer supplies and great difficulties trying to maintain supply lines between Canada and his army as it advanced south into New York. This required large baggage trains for which the army had inadequate horses, wagons, and drivers to carry them. It did not help that Burgoyne was bringing a large artillery train that, as I said, included 2 12-pounders and 2 24-pounders. These large guns were far heavier than most field guns, which rarely rated higher than 6-pounders. If Burgoyne had concerns about these limitations, he did not let it show to others. He had a can-do attitude and was going forward aggressively as he had promised officials in London. By June 20, 1777, his army was ready to begin its move from St. John toward their first target, Fort Ticonderoga. Next week, the Americans at Fort Ticonderoga prepare to defend against the British offensive. Hey, thanks for joining the American Revolution Podcast After Show. I want to thank Tyson France this week for his continued support of the podcast as a Robert Morris Circle supporter on Patreon. Tyson runs Liberty & Co., a website where you can buy items with a revolution or constitution theme. Tyson's always got a great and always updated inventory of interesting items, free shipping, and if you use the code AMREV, that's AMREV, you can get 20% off your order. Also, several Patreon supporters this month have reduced or ended their support due to changed financial situations during this COVID-19 pandemic emergency. I just want to say to everyone that I completely understand, and I'm really grateful for the support you have given me in the past. It's my fondest hope that you and your families make it through these difficult times. And to any other supporters who are thinking about ending their support, for now at least, due to their changed financial circumstances, please do not feel guilty at all for doing so. I completely understand. I will keep publishing through this crisis and will keep this podcast free to all. Also, don't forget, if you want to buy any books that I've recommended, you can click on the links on my website so that I get a small commission from Amazon. A few months ago, Amazon forced me to take down my disclaimer, which noted that if you use that link to go to Amazon but then buy other products, I still get commissions on whatever you buy. With lots more people ordering on Amazon these days, this is a great way to support the podcast without spending any more than you would anyway. For some reason, Amazon does not want me to say this on my website. Instead, Amazon requires that I now use the vague line that says, "As an Amazon associate, I earn from qualifying purchases." Note that on some older episodes, that line does not appear. That's because I just haven't gotten around to updating those links yet. But if you plan to buy something on Amazon, if you would access the site through one of the links from my blog, that really would help me and help fund the podcast at no cost to you. In this week's episode, I mostly gave background on some of the top officers that would be supporting General Burgoyne as he prepared to begin his invasion of upstate New York. This marks the beginning of the Saratoga campaign, which, in my mind at least, ends up being the decisive turning point of the war. The campaign lasts about 3 months, and it's probably going to take me at least that long to cover it. The second half of 1777 is going to be a very busy time. I also wanted to mention that I listened back to my recording of this episode and realized that I kept calling the German-speaking troops Hessians. Of course, most of these soldiers were from Brunswick, not Hesse, but to be fair, most of the British officers at the time just called them Hessians as well. Still, I'm going to try to be better about using the more generic term German in the future. German, of course, refers to the language, not the nation of Germany, which would not exist until well into the 19th century. Also, in researching this week's episode, I spent what was probably an inordinate amount of time researching how the British artillery fit into the overall military command structure. And despite all my work, I'm still not sure I understand exactly, as there seems to be a great deal of contradictory information out there. As I said in the main show, the artillery was run by the Department of Ordnance, while the Navy, as well as the infantry and cavalry, were managed by the Secretary at War. This division of duty did not change until the mid-19th century. Some sources I've read said that artillery officers could not give orders to army officers even when the artillery officer held a higher rank, similar to what was the case with colonial officers not being permitted to give orders to officers in the regular army. My profound thanks to Eric Schnitzer from Saratoga National Park, Professor Greg Irwin of Temple University, Dutchess County historian Will Tatum, and author and editor of the Journal of the American Revolution, Don Hagest, who are all experts in this area. All of them took the time to answer my many obscure questions on this topic and tried to set me straight. After getting their input, my understanding, which I will be the first to admit may still be flawed, is that a superior artillery officer could in fact give orders to officers in the infantry or cavalry, but that artillery officers were not given positions of command. Artillery generally did seem to be treated as support staff by the other branches. Artillery was not a path you would take if you wanted to become a commanding general someday. In any event, going down that rabbit hole took several weeks of my life to sort out, all of which was to answer my question about how artillery officer General William Phillips became a major general in America, second in command to Burgoyne himself during this mission, and why that was so controversial to officials in London. All of this leads me to this week's book recommendation, Where a Man Can Go, Major General William Phillips, British Royal Artillery, 1731-1781, by Robert P. Davis. This book delves into the life of General Phillips and focuses on his role in the American Revolution. I found it to be a very interesting biography about a man that I really knew little about before reading. The book itself is relatively short, less than 200 pages, not counting notes, index, and appendices. The author, Robert Davis, was a career soldier and a longtime Revolutionary War enthusiast. He published this book in 1999 and sadly passed away in 2010. The one thing that really made me reluctant to recommend this book is that it is rather hard to get. It costs $80 on Amazon due to its limited availability. As I said, it's a good book, but $80 for a 200-page book is about 40 cents a page. That just seems a little pricey to me. So, if you've got your interest up about British artillery history and don't want to lay out $80 for Davis's book, you might enjoy my online recommendation this week. It's a public domain ebook available on archive.org called History of the Royal Regiment of Artillery by Francis Duncan. This book gets into the origins of Britain's artillery. It explains how the Board of Ordnance formed the first regiment and set up the first military school for training artillerists. The book was written in 1879, only a short time after the artillery got merged into the War Department. The author was a captain in the Royal Artillery. The book, of course, is in the public domain and available free online. You can search for it at archive.org or use the link on my website at amrevpodcast.com. One other quick mention about archive.org. In addition to public domain books, the website has many books available online that are still in copyright. Now, normally, you are limited to reserving about 5 of these books at any one time, and a limited number of readers can access any book at once, meaning that there are often wait lists to get to these books. Archive.org recently announced that they are raising those limits and removing the wait lists until at least June 2020, or perhaps longer, if the pandemic continues to keep your local library closed. So, if you're looking for books to read, archive.org just made their collection of newer works much more available. Hope you enjoy it. Well, that's all for this week. I hope you will join me again next week for another American Revolution podcast.